Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, and welcome to the Whale Hunting Podcast, where we shine a light onto hidden worlds of money and power. I'm Bradley Hope, and this week I'm joined by Jane Bradley, a Pulitzer and Orwell-nominated investigative correspondent currently covering the UK for the New York Times. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So you had this amazing story about Interpol a few weeks ago. The first thing I was going to ask you is, most people have no idea what Interpol does. They think that they're like a police force. And in the movies, they always seem to be like, hey, I'm from Interpol, freeze, kind of thing. What do they actually do, and why are they important?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And you know what? When you first start reporting on Interpol, the first thing you will always be told is everything Interpol isn't, right? So there's this Hollywood idea that they carry out raids like the FBI, that they conduct their own investigations. But essentially, they're kind of this really powerful global digital bulletin board where police forces, law enforcement agencies across the world share information about suspects, targets, basically crime and fugitives that they're hunting for. And they don't have the power to carry out their own investigation. They don't even have the power to conduct arrests themselves. And they're always very keen to stress that. But the information, the databases Interpol holds are so powerful and so important for international crime, because effectively what you're doing is you're giving every country that's a part of Interpol the power to not only, you know, hunt for someone within their own country, but to basically reach across borders and grab their targets. Criminals, in theory, that they're after, and it allows them to reach way across their own borders to even, you know, democracies and things like that.
And I guess not every country has like extradition treaties, but at least it would be information like this person is in our country or something, right?
Yeah, there are, you know, other tactics or the methods that law enforcement agencies can use, like mutual legal aid assistance or, you know, like extradition treatments, but they're really slow and clunky and they take forever. And Interpol's thing is that you publish a red notice or an arrest alert or a request for help, and it's almost instant, right? So when there's a fugitive on the run or a really hot case, you get help potentially immediately, and that's why it's so useful and kind of offers something that other methods might not.
So in theory, if a fugitive runs away from the UK and they show up somewhere and the UK had submitted a red notice, it could be quite instantaneous that like it would flag up in their, you know, at the airports and stuff?
Yeah, the red notices are less quick than they used to be because there's way more checks. Back in the day, before the current leader of Interpol took office, you used to just be able to circulate red notices, this request for that another law enforcement agency is making an arrest for you, instantly. There'd be no checks and it would kind of be looked at afterwards. So that would be instant. But the other thing is that you can kind of blast out these requests to all 196 member countries of Interpol, right? Whereas with an extradition treaty, it's directly to one country. So that's also what makes it powerful. If you don't know where the person you're looking for is, you can just put it on the bulletin board and you could get help or alerts from all these other countries.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so obviously there's different kinds of mechanisms that they can use. Can you just walk through what those are? There's blue, red.
Yeah, it kind of gets a bit confusing, but the one that Interpol is known most famously for is its red notice, and that's the most powerful notice it's got. That basically is an arrest alert requesting that another authority in another country makes an arrest on behalf of, you know, Russia, the US, something like that. So the red notice is what's most widely known because they're also the one that's kind of been most dogged by controversy, effectively. Like they're the ones that have been misused by autocrats, by strongmen. There is a bunch of, you know, famous cases where these notices haven't actually been used to pursue real criminals, but politically motivated targets of authoritarian regime. Most famously, you know, investigative journalist from Venezuela who was arrested in Peru on the basis of a red notice. There was an Egyptian asylum seeker who was arrested in Australia. And then most famously, there's Bill Browder. He used to be an investment fund manager in Russia who turned enemy of Putin. And he has been targeted repeatedly through Interpol by Russia. So that has all kind of been well documented and is pretty well known by this point. But there's this whole bunch of other notices which people know very little about. And the most useful of those, from what I've been told, is something called a blue notice. And that's basically a request for information about a target. It can be location, which is its main use, but it can be kind of anything else. And it's much broader than a red notice. So you can use it not just against a suspect in a criminal investigation. You can use it if you're looking for a witness, a victim of a crime. But they're basically, it's basically being used in some cases as de facto red notices, where a country like Russia will issue one through Interpol. They'll find out the location of a target thereafter, and then they will issue a red notice or a diffusion, or they will request an arrest.
The problem is the definition of a criminal is very different from different points of view, right? Somebody might think that Edward Snowden is a criminal and somebody might think he's not a criminal. But red notices can result in people getting detained right away, right? I think there was a case I remember of in Dubai where a woman was suddenly arrested for weeks and weeks before she got released. And it's almost like a form of punishment as well, even besides the potential for them to get extradited back to their country.
Yeah, and it's also being used, like you say, as kind of as a weapon of harassment as well, not necessarily to get them back to their home country. But, you know, we've seen China using it against Uyghurs, for example, who have fled China in London and other parts of the world. And they're using it just as a way they find out, you know, where they are. They can then harass them and intimidate them rather than thinking they're going to be extradited back to the country. So there are really, really powerful tool in the right hands, but also in the wrong hands. And the other really powerful Interpol tool, which is also being abused, one of the new ways that's being abused, is something called the Stolen and Lost Travel Documents Database, or the passport database, basically. So in theory, it's this really important anti-terrorism tool because, you know, often terrorists will travel on stolen passports, right? But it's being abused by various countries, Turkey and Belarus being two kind of key examples, where basically they're falsely flagging the passports of a political opponent, an enemy, as lost or stolen. So then when they next travel on it, outside of wherever their home country is, it's revoked when they're traveling. And then either the passport is taken off them and they're either sent back to their home country, which wants them for whatever reason, or they're kind of stranded and exiled. And that's really hard for Interpol to fix because they can't issue a new passport. Like, they can fix a red notice, a blue notice, but if a passport's been cancelled and someone's exiled or stranded or worse, deported back, they can't really do anything about it.
And so you wrote this story that kind of talked about these new trends of abuse. What does Interpol say that they're doing about it? Or what are the, and also what are the kind of things they can do about it to some extent?
Yeah. So the first thing to say is that Interpol has made some really major progress in tackling red notice abuse because they've received the most heat on it. So they have, you know, they've set up a task force, they're now checked before they're circulated, things like that. With notices like blue notices, they're only just now, I think, realizing what a potential problem or what a problem they are, and they're starting to look at the checks in place for issuing them. And they kind of reject the suggestion that blue notices or other notices can be used to circumvent red notice abuse. And, you know, they say they ultimately, blue notices get the same checks as red notices by the same team. But the issue being they're not checked till after they've gone out, right? And for a lot of people, that can be too late. And we got some new figures from Interpol, which hadn't been released before, which showed that since 2018, there's been 700 blue notices that have violated Interpol rules, not all for political abuse, for various reasons. And that's something that they're now looking at, is my understanding. And with the passport database, the abuse by Turkey got so bad that they actually temporarily banned Turkey from using it, full stop. But, you know, I spoke to people who it was too late for, basically. They'd already been flagged on the passport database. They're now effectively exiled away from, you know, family, wife, kids, things like that, because they traveled on the passport without realizing it. Belarus is a newer example that they're seeing, and it's currently under special measures, basically meaning it's got enhanced checks before they'll accept someone on the database. So they are trying to tackle it, but they've been a bit slow waking up from it, is what my reporting suggests.
The other thing about Interpol that's kind of weird is that it's got a European headquarters with a person in charge, but there's also a rotating president.
Yeah, so effectively, you've got the secretary general, who's like the CEO, and that at the moment is a German official called Jürgen Stock, and that's where the real power is. Then you've got the president, which kind of heads up something called the executive committee, which is this influential board of, it's usually 13 members of countries from around the world who are all part of Interpol. And the president is interesting because Interpol will always and has argued that, you know, it's a, basically it's kind of like a ceremonial role. It doesn't have much power or sway, but that's quite a convenient argument to make given the current president is UAE and Emirati police officer who is facing multiple lawsuits in multiple jurisdictions accused of torture and arbitrary detention and disappearances. So I'm a bit skeptical of that. And I have to say, I was at the Interpol's annual general assembly, which is this big conference where everyone comes from all over the world and discusses whatever the priorities are of the day. And he had a central role in that ceremony, the speeches, the introductions, the panel discussions. And to me, it didn't look like a very ceremonial role, though it definitely has less power than the CEO. And then the executive committee members, they have power to kind of influence priorities for Interpol. And most importantly, there's an election coming up this year where Interpol is going to elect its first new leader in 14 years. And it's only those 11 countries who get a vote on who becomes the next leader. So before the election, there's lots of like political jockeying and stuff to see who can get a seat on the board that makes that vote. And, you know, when you are on that board and you have a vote, you're in a really influential position and you're in a position to negotiate with whoever's running for the top job. In this case, we've got candidates from Britain, Brazil, Pakistan, and Zambia. And basically, it's all about the deal. Like, who the candidate is matters, you know, that they've got some good policing experience and they're seen as a sensible pair of hands. But a lot of it does come down to the politics and the diplomacy. And that's what I found really interesting, that, you know, I was speaking to officials from India who were basically, you know, talking about, yeah, look, we're going to weigh up what deal everyone offers us and go with who gives us the best deal. We'll always weigh up our best options. Britain's been lobbying us for months, but we're not going to make a decision until Brazil comes to us and tells us what they're going to offer. So, it could be something like a mutual vote in a future election. It could be promising resources for something that's important to them. It could be a trade deal or something like that. But for an organisation that goes on about how politically neutral it is, there was a surprising amount of politics and diplomacy at play. I spoke to the head of the National Crime Agency here, kind of Britain's FBI, who kind of spoke about how post-Brexit and the UK kind of losing its membership of Europol, that Interpol had taken on increased importance to them because they realised they'd been undervaluing it, and actually now they're out of the big European law enforcement agency. They needed and wanted that international influence on another platform. So it's partly about influencing, you know, crime priorities and what money is spent on what in terms of international crime, but it's also massively political and it does hold quite a lot of influence on a global stage.
And is there a clear front runner at the moment, or is it still kind of like anyone's game?
I knew you were going to ask me that. after the media's failure to predict so much in the last 5 or so years, I'm very wary of making a bet on that. I would say the front runners are seen to be, at least internally, the British candidate, a veteran cop called Stephen Kavanagh, and the Brazilian candidate, a guy called Valdecio Quiza. But everybody is wary of placing any bets, and Interpol and geopolitics is full of surprises. The Zambian candidate is still strong, and the Pakistani candidate apparently has a great background in kind of international diplomacy. But in terms of the campaigning and all the outreach and the platform resources, it seems to be between Britain and Brazil at this stage.
There's also, if I recall, there's quite a lot of politicking around the president job too, right? Like when the China guy, Ming Hongwei, when he won, I remember there was a whole lot of exploration of how they built that support by offering people free police technology or building police stations around the world and that sort of thing too, right?
Totally. And I think there were some emails that came out that showed kind of China suggesting, well, basically playing into the resources invested in Interpol, and a reminder of that when with the vote coming up. And same with the Emirati current president. The UAE gave Interpol a huge donation in the year running up to him being elected. Now, I asked about that at an Interpol conference I went to in September, and I feel like I almost got thrown out for it. They were very kind of sensitive about that, and they insist that obviously funding doesn't influence anything at Interpol, but you can't deny the existence of those emails from China, the fact that the UAE contributed, made such a huge donation before its president got elected. And even in the case of this election, the UK in the run-up has been a huge funder of Interpol.
And there, isn't there like, is it the Interpol Foundation which receives a lot of those donations?
In the case of the UAE, yeah, I think that that received like pretty much all, if not all, of the UAE's funding, but they're actually closing that down. I think the controversy kind of, despite the protests, did break through.
The I remember we did an article in the journal about Ming Hongwei. You know, that was obviously was a pretty crazy affair where one day he just went missing, right? And they trying to find him at Interpol. And Interpol, the globe's most informed police organization, had no idea where their president was. Do you know that story?
I do know that story. I was speaking a little to his wife, actually, Grace. And yeah, it was extraordinary. And also I know that his wife, who's been campaigning on his behalf since his disappearance and all the rest, was very disappointed in how Interpol handled the situation, you know, putting out a statement announcing his resignation before investigating like where the hell he'd gone to and what had gone on, and just felt like institutionally there wasn't any support or like drilling down, like you say, you know, the world's largest police organization, and they just couldn't find out what happened to him despite China being part of their organization.
And I think his last message to his wife was a knife and a blood drop.
Yeah.
Emoji.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't exactly fill you with confidence when someone goes missing.
What I remember is there was an allegation of corruption against him.
Yeah.
And so he was called back to China and they essentially disappeared him. Mm-hmm. And then they tried to come and get his wife too. They sent different people there as emissaries, like a business person on a private jet. And they tried to convince her to get on the plane. The idea was to disappear her as well, so that she couldn't make a big fuss about the missing her missing husband.
Wow.
And there was a big corruption case. And I think that he's emerged in a court trial.
Mm.
But like, I think the sentence wasn't good.
No, and we still don't know exactly where he is, right?
We just think he's in China, right?
Yeah.
But is this a good example of kind of the weirdness of even that job, you know?
Yeah.
And also the weirdness of China, to be honest,
yeah,
because they just disappeared their own president of Interpol.
And also the weirdness of kind of Interpol and the challenge it has in that it's, you've got 196 member countries, right? And you've got democracies, the US, the UK, we've got our own problems, but, you know, we're not an autocratic regime. And then you're working alongside some really concerning authoritarian regimes, autocrat strongmen, who have very different ideas about how crime and stuff should work. And it's quite a challenge for Interpol to kind of balance this huge dysfunctional family with very different ideas about how the firm should be run.
Yeah, because I would imagine if you're a small country and you can exert a lot of influence over Interpol, it's really a great leverager for your country's power. Then, you know, a place like the UAE doesn't really have a sophisticated international presence even. They have ambassadors and they have diplomats, but they don't have like a fully functioning CIA kind of thing. Like, it's all very small, mostly subcontracted. But if you can have some look in on Interpol, that would be very valuable, I would imagine.
Yeah.
And not to mention the optics of it, because the UAE gets so much criticism for harboring criminals, right? But one of the cases we came across was Isabel dos Santos, the daughter of the former president of Angola. She is living in Dubai. There's an Interpol red notice for her, yet the president of Interpol is from the UAE and they haven't acted upon it. So it's kind of, it's also clear that no one feels they have to do anything related to Interpol. It's all kind of voluntary. So it's also kind of a voluntary organization, right? So there's not a lot of follow through when it doesn't feel convenient for the parties involved.
No, it doesn't. And the argument they always fall back on, which, you know, there is some value in, but I think is overused, is that
look, we have to still be in bed with the likes of Russia, the UAE, because what about when there are terrorists on the run? What about if there are paedophiles we're after? It always comes back to, you know, the cost is worth it for the global cooperation to tackling crime. And that's always the kind of be all and end all. And it makes everything else okay, which I think is problematic for many people.
Getting inside Interpol and then also your previous work, you know, chasing down these kind of mysterious Russians that died when you were at BuzzFeed. How do you, like, what's your kind of style of journalism? How do you figure things out? Like, what's your secret skill?
I don't think it's that secret or that special to me, but I would say, like, I'm a source reporter first and foremost, in that I love and I'm decent at getting people to talk to me, people who haven't spoken before or haven't spoken to anybody else. I feel like all the best stories that I've ever done and that great journalists I know have done pretty much have started with a tip off from a source. But I don't think you can be a good investigative journalist unless you can also handle documents, right? So often it will start with a source. And then same with the Russia investigation, it started with a tip-off from one of the family members of one of the guy who mysteriously died, Scott Young's wife, from her to my old boss, Heidi Blake. And then we found out she had all these documents that we could kind of go through in terms of the police investigation and communications with like Russia and things like that. So I think just talking to people and figuring out who would know what is always a starting point. And then you're looking for documents to corroborate, to put flesh on the bones. I think that's the golden standard in terms of like evidence and being able to publish a story. But before like getting the tip off, you've got to figure out who knows what you want to know. So a little bit before that, a lot of that comes from, for me at least, looking at buried annual reports, academic research, press clippings to figure out, okay, who will know what I'm interested in or who might have something interesting to say about this.
Yeah, totally agree. I think it's almost the hardest way to ever do journalism would be to start with documents and then end with people.
Yes. Yeah.
Because you're so confused for so long. And then it turns out there's this one person that if you call them, they can cut right through and tell you exactly what's going on.
Exactly.
But it's always impressive, people who are very document focused, how sometimes something very wrong is there in plain view. You know, like even in financial journalism, a lot of the great stories came about because there was some little twist in that financial statement and somebody just kind of started pulling on it. So it's possible.
Yeah, it is. Or like when you look through the annex of like a 100-page report that nobody else has bothered to look at, there'll just be some line in there that is just the breadcrumb trail, which leads you to the bigger story. So definitely they can be used and can lead to a tip-off. I just find the bigger stories generally originate from a person who's telling you something that they probably shouldn't.
The other thing that's good I always found is to always ask for the documents, because sometimes something happens, there can be an error, they can give you too much. Or I had that experience myself where I requested documents from the BVI and they gave me by accident the certificate of incumbency for that company. So it said who actually owned it. It was meant to be secret, and they got like caught in the copying machine or whatever. So that, you never know, right? You have to do the work. So what at the New York Times, what's been your kind of theme that you're trying to explore? What's the kind of area that you're kind of fishing, I guess?
I have quite a broad beat in that I will do stories about financial crime and corruption. I will do social justice, social inequality. I like being able to kind of move around because I like to just jump in a story where I think something outrageous is happening or wrong. I kind of finish one big story and I'm like, God, I never want to look at a database again. Or another story, I'm like, God, it's so hard dealing with victims of trauma that I want to do like a document-based type story. But I'd say like if there's an overarching theme, and this is quite a broad one, but I think it's one that lots of investigative journalists follow, it's holding power to account and looking at abuses of power. It's definitely that kind of money influence power world that kind of really interests me. And the bigger the institution, the more interested I'm in. So obviously, Parliament is a big one, big corporations. I've done a bit looking at the royal family, the money side of things rather than the circus side of things. So that really, really interests me, I would say. That would be the broad umbrella.
And where can people try to follow you and get in touch with you in general?
Not Twitter anymore. It's a cesspit. No, generally, I mean, I'm on email, I'm on LinkedIn, I'm off ProtonMail, Signal on request, stuff like that. And a big reason I actually, like, even though I talk nonstop, I don't actually like doing media stuff. I don't like doing radio interviews. I don't like doing TV. But I always force myself to do them because the number of times I've had like a source or a tip come off from someone hearing you on the TV or the radio and realizing there's someone they could reach out to if there's something wrong going on really, yeah, really helps and makes the pain of it worthwhile. And like I said, no one reads my stuff, but if I'm on a podcast, then my mum's very excited.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week. Thanks to Jane for joining us. The best way to stay up to date with whale hunting is to hit follow wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also subscribe to the Whale Hunting newsletter for updates on the shadowy lives of the powerful and ultra wealthy at whalehunting.projectbrazen.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week for more.
Whale Hunting is a production of Project Brazen. It's hosted by me, Tom Wright, and Bradley Hope. It's produced by Megan Dean and Claire Urban. At Project Brazen, Mariangel Gonzalez is our project manager. Ryan Ho is the creative director, with additional design from Andrea Klarich.